Well, hello there, Internet. We didn't specifically discuss how to begin this podcast before this exact moment, and you'll understand why that is significant for me in just a little while. Speaking of which, that's a fantastic book in and of itself. We Three is a graphic novel. Look it up.
Oh, okay.
We Three are myself, Bill. You are?
Yeah, call me Wyatt.
And you are?
Call me Ishmael.
And I'm Marissa.
All right. This is going to be the flagship episode of the sub-show, sub-podcast mini-series unfolding event known as the Benchcast Book Club. What we're using this platform for is basically the discussion of some books that we're reading for no other purpose than to share them with you and basically to bounce them off of other people and just be excited about sharing books. I should have said that with a more excited inflection, but I didn't.
Be excited about sharing books.
That's exactly right.
Knowledge is power.
Yeah. Okay, so who do we want to start off here? I feel like we should roll a dice or something, because it's like a gaming store. I can start off.
Yeah, go for it. You got your book in your hand.
If you don't mind.
Bill, tell us about the book that you chose to read.
Okay, so I was originally going to start with, I think it's Discipline Equals Freedom or something like that, from Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. It's like a book about self-discipline and like military discipline and stuff like that. But then I decided roughly 3 weeks ago that it would be a great time to have a full-blown spiritual crisis.
Because why not?
Yeah, because
it is November.
Yeah. We are
winter is coming.
Getting into the month of death. And so I've had this book forever. I've had this book since I went to university in Thunder Bay. This book is called The Tao Te Ching, and it is a philosophical text from like early China. It's basically a whole bunch of different verses, little poems, and it tries its best to describe what the Tao is. Tao is spelled T-A-O. So if you are a practicer of Tao, you would be a Taoist or you follow Taoism. But that in and of itself is kind of a complication of the whole system. The system is super philosophical and super wishy-washy. So I'll give you the preface to what I'm about to show you, the book that I've actually selected. So the first thing that this says, verse 1 of the Tao Te Ching, which this whole system is based on, verse 1 states, "A way that can be walked is not the way. A name that can be named is not the name." So the whole premise here is that if you're talking to somebody about Taoism or you're talking about the Tao and you're trying to explain it as X or it is a representation of Y or you can see it here, that's not it. The whole thing is it cannot be explained by definition. And so even by trying to explain that it cannot be explained is not Tao. It's a very, as I said, very wishy-washy way of going about things. Anyways, the book I've wanted to talk about here is from Alan Watts. He's a super critically acclaimed philosopher, big time on Eastern philosophy, Eastern religion, stuff like that. The book is called Tao, The Watercourse Way. It was the last book he wrote before he died. And if you ever want to just trip absolute balls, go on YouTube and look up Alan Watts, because some of the stuff, it's like any classical philosophy are ideas that have been around forever. And they're like universal truths. Everybody knows this to be true, like spreading positivity and trying to be a positive person. Everybody knows you feel good when you do that.
Right.
So you should try and do that more. But it's hard to put into practice. That's kind of why it's a philosophy, right? So I'm going to read you a passage from this book, page 20, so that you can get an idea about what this guy is coming at you from. So he says, in describing Tao, or the duality of light and dark. Because the idea is that Tao encompasses everything, the lightness and the darkness. It is, and of course you can't really describe it, but it is a representation of everything as it is. So this guy says, people who have been brought up in the aura of Christian and Hebrew aspirations find this frustrating because it seems to deny any possibility of progress, an ideal which flows from their linear, as distinct from cyclic, view of time and history. Indeed, the whole enterprise of Western technology is to make the world a better place, to have pleasure without pain, wealth without poverty, and health without sickness. But, as is now becoming obvious, our violent efforts to achieve this ideal with such weapons as DDT, penicillin, nuclear energy, automotive transportation, computers, industrial farming, damning, and compelling everyone by law to be superficially good and healthy are creating more problems than they solve. So this guy's essentially, this is an introduction to the whole yin and yang philosophy behind Taoism. That's where the yin yang comes from, in saying that you can't have one without the other. It is a complete cycle and always will be. The next quick thing I wanted to read you is kind of like a little story that he uses to illustrate what the cycle looks like and how somebody who identifies with Tao as a philosophy might approach the cycle. Because the idea is that we have no control over the cycle. The cycle happens just like before you were alive, you were ostensibly dead, and you will be dead once again. It just is a cycle, a lot like when the sun comes up, it provides light. Even if I don't like it, it's still light outside. That's just what's up.
Right.
So this guy says, a Taoist story of a farmer whose horse ran away. That evening, the neighbors gathered to commiserate with him, since this was such bad luck. He said, maybe. The next day, the horse returned, but brought with it six wild horses, and the neighbors came exclaiming at his good fortune. He said, maybe. And then, the following day, his son tried to saddle and ride one of the wild horses, was thrown, and broke his leg. Again, the neighbors came to offer their sympathy for his misfortune. He said, maybe. The day after that, conscription officers came to the village to seize young men for the army. But, because of the broken leg, the farmer's son was rejected. When the neighbors came to say how fortunately everything has turned out, he said, maybe.
I just heard this within the last 48 hours for the first time ever.
Did you?
I think it was on the Joe Rogan podcast, and I think it was the one with, it was either Trevor Valley or Trevor Vale, or however you pronounce the last name, the paleontologist, or it was the one with Dave Rubin. I can't remember, but I had just heard that. 48 hours ago, it blew my mind when you said, a man lost his horse. I'm like, oh my God, I know exactly where
Wacky.
This is going. For the first time in my life, I heard that within the last 48 hours. Unbelievable.
It's fate.
I'll tell you that I had, you know how like sometimes stupid little experiences can just like rattle your sense of self and your sense of like, okay, I basically know what's going on here. I'm a dad. I'm a business owner, I'm this and that. I wear these hats. This is the way I go about my shit. This is how I do.
Important stuff doesn't throw me for a loop. It's always the really like,
and then just like
niche stuff.
Boop, this little tiny thing, and I'm like, I don't know anything. I don't know anything. And this little stupid thing was at jiu-jitsu. I got slammed real good by this guy. And he's a little bit smaller than I am. And I've actually determined that I'm going to tell him this story because it's that impactful. But I just got to be weary about the way I do it because it could come across as weird. And anyways, he slammed me down real good. The type of slam down where when my back hit the mat, he got one of those, like it just like sucked the air out of my lungs and got that like, just like monkey energy, right? And so he heard that and obviously like recognized the fact that he like just smoked me, and he stopped immediately, and turned towards me. And the best way I can describe it is he held me like I would hold my son. And he put both of his hands underneath, like if I'm doing it to you, he's got both of his hands underneath your chin and like almost like supporting your cheeks with his thumbs up like near my eyes and held me like that. And you gotta imagine, we've been rolling now for an hour and a half. Everybody's stinky, sweaty, stops. And I swear to God, my whole world went womp. And I just got that like, and my brain just went like, whoop, into this guy's world, man. And he stopped and he was like, are you okay? And I was like, yep. And he's like, are you okay? I'm worried. And I was like, oh, I don't know what's going on. We're here to hurt each other. And it was just like this like immediate duality, just like, lightning bolted my head, and I was all fucked. Like, I went back, like, after class and stuff, I went back into my truck, and I was like, what is happening right now? That's not... I get the affection that comes with fighting, grappling, that kind of thing. Like, it's not affection, it's respect. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you get really tuned, you can still give the guy a hug and be like, yeah, you... tune me up. Like, that's just, yeah. That's what's up. That's
odd that combatants can have mutual respect for each other.
That's just what happened. I just got smoked. Yeah. Thank you very much for showing me that I'm not as strong as I think I am.
Yeah.
And that instance, that specific instance, I got home and I was like, you know what I should do? I should reread the Tao Te Ching because I haven't read that. Usually I read 1984 every year and it just rekindles my hatred of government and stuff like that. I was like, I should reread the Tao Te Ching. And I started going through it, and I was like, oh, this feels a lot differently than it did when I was in university. And so, yeah, I bought, like, 4 or 5 books on, like, Taoism and, like, 2 or 3 from Alan Watts because he's just the man. And, like, since that specific night and escalating to the point where, like, now... it's almost like meditation. When you practice meditation, when you practice it as like a skill, like you're learning how to draw, every once in a while, you feel non-feeling. And then you have one of those moments, and it's exceptional when you got a little bit of pot in your system because it just like goes, it's that and you just, there's a weird transcendence, and then you realize, oh, I'm doing it. And as soon as you realize you're doing it, you're not doing it anymore. But you get that like, oh, I was just there. It was just happening. You know, and it's just for the sake of saving time, it's very difficult to describe where the mindset is right now. But this makes a lot of sense right now. And very specifically, too, with like raising a kid, there's so many ways that you can bridge duality, or you can bridge light and dark. You can bridge the way. Tao is roughly translated to the path or the way. And if you're following the way, you're not following the way because the way just happens. You know, and there's so many of these instances, you're going to find this out where you just, all of the sudden, you got to go with the flow. Because if you try and force it right now, it ain't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and...
I think you know, unintentionally do a decent job of not letting real stuff... Like, that's funny, real stuff bother me, but I do a great job of letting... Not unimportant, but things I have no control over bother me. So, like, no, that's not even really what I mean. Like, you know, if all of a sudden... a shelf in my kitchen let go and all of my dishes broke and they're lying right in the middle of the floor, I'd be like, okay, I need to sweep up all these dishes, figure out why that happened, and maybe go get some more dishes.
Yeah.
My wife would be losing her mind, but I'd be like, okay, that happened and this is the appropriate response. We need to clean that up. But then I'll come home and be like, did you know that like caterpillars are going extinct in Borneo right now, and it would keep me awake at night. But like, you know, or yeah, you know, our car just died, and we got to get a new car. Okay, well, we'll go get another car. I know, but it's like, what do we do? We'll figure it out. And then some little nuanced thing that has nothing to do with my day-to-day will worry the hell out of me. But like a big personal crisis happens, it's like, okay, that's cool. I can handle that.
It's wacky, man. It's very difficult to explain without doing like the campfire talk. You know what I mean? Like when you, something happens to the human brain when everybody, after you've passed snacks around, after everybody's got a refilled beer, you're doing what you're doing, you're having a good time, there's that weird transcendent moment where everybody's just looking at the fire. And you just get that, like, I can't not look at it. And immediately, everybody's thinking about, I wonder what the hell happens when you die. And, like, all those weird questions start coming in. And you can't talk about this kind of stuff without getting into that.
Yeah.
And that'll kill a couple hours here. So why don't we talk about something else? That's what I'm reading in any case.
Yeah? I might borrow that Alan Watts one off, yeah.
It is positively fantastic so far. I mean, that's second sticky note. That's where I am so
far.
I'll
wait until the days get a little longer. That's not a good winter book for me.
It's also like, it's not like reading a story or something. I have to read two or three pages and then be like, okay, I need to sit on that for a couple days. Do I agree with this?
Yeah.
Like figure out like where I am with this. But yeah, so what are you guys reading? Who wants to go next?
The floor is yours, Marissa.
Okay. It's actually been probably 2 or 2.5 weeks since I finished this, so which is a little ironic because of the subject matter of the book, but I read Moonwalking with Einstein by Joshua Foer with a subtitle of The Art and Science of Remembering Everything.
Whoa.
And I've had to, in the last couple of days, go back and do a brief flip through of it to remember what the hell was going on in it. But this came out a few years ago, and I read it around the same time that it came out, so this was a reread for me. But it's, well, I'll read the little bit of the blurb on the back for kind of a general description. While researching an article on the USA Memory Championships, Joshua Foer was equally dubious and intrigued by one contestant's claim that even an average memory, if used properly, could win the event. And after a year of memory training, he found himself in the finals of that same championship. Under the tutelage of mental athletes, Foer learns ancient techniques once employed by Cicero to memorize his speeches and by medieval scholars to memorize entire books. So this is a story of this guy who was a freelance writer and is actually one of the founders of Atlas Obscura, which I found out maybe like 4 or 5 days ago. And he decided to originally plan to write an article about these memory championships and got to know some of the guys that were taking part in them, and eventually went on this journey of over the course of a year to train himself in memory techniques to improve his memory and enter into one of these, and ended up becoming the USA memory champion in, I think, 2006, and went on to the World Championships like the following year.
Hmm. The USA Memory Championships.
There's a champion for everything.
Yeah, there's a championship for everything.
Yeah. And it's insane. One of the main techniques that they mention in this, and you may have heard of it, is the idea of the memory palace. And I tried to follow the sort of rundown that they give you in this. Didn't really work because I'm, you know, not as dedicated to
it. You're not a memory champion.
Yep, exactly. But the idea is that you can take a list of things, whether it's your grocery list or your to-do list, anything from items to people's phone numbers to I got to remember to email what's-her-face about blah, 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 you know, 3 days from now. And using a specific location that you are really familiar with, they suggest to you something like your childhood home, you know, the house that you're currently living in, somewhere that you are very familiar with, the entire layout of it, placing the items on your whatever it is that you have to memorize in locations or like areas of that place vividly, creating a mental picture. So say your list is like, well, I'll just do three because it's super easy. You need to buy eggs, you need to call your mom, and you need to buy a new pair of shoes. So standing at the front door of your childhood home, you're going to picture a giant carton of eggs, and maybe it's like lit up with neon lights, and like the eggs have little feet and they're dancing around.
Weird.
And then you walk into your kitchen, and standing in your kitchen is your mom, and she's yelling at you that you need to call her later today. And then you walk into your childhood bedroom, and there's a brand new pair of shiny shoes sitting on your bed waiting for you. Like, you need to buy new shoes.
I could see how that'd be effective.
Yeah.
And then you can go back, whatever, you know, if it's a list of three things or it's a list of 25 things, you can go back later through your memory palace in the order walking through, whether it's, you know, your childhood house, a library that you're really familiar with, whatever it may be, and remember in order all of these things by creating such a vivid mental picture. Because if you just try and think, you know, oh, I got to go to the grocery store and get eggs and chickpeas and bananas, and you might, you know, leave things out because
I always forget one thing off my list. It's just a list
of words. Yeah. If it's just a list of words, you're less likely to remember it than if it's these crazy mental pictures.
That's wild, because like while you were saying those things, I'm like, okay, I got some eggs dancing at the front door of my house.
So did I. I was like,
there's my mom yelling at me in the kitchen, telling me I got to call her. And I walk into my room, and there's some shoes on my bed. God, that's weird, man.
Yeah.
I'm going to buy eggs next time I go grocery shopping.
You're like, I don't know why, but I feel like I need these. Yeah. And you start checking out your shoes. Wow.
So that's cool.
Yeah. And so then they get into a bit of the science of it. And kind of why that is. And it's because as humans, our brains work better with remembering things like imagery than with lists, words, numbers. That's why it's so, you know, people nowadays, we have to use our cell phones for everything. The only telephone number that I can remember is my own and maybe my parents' house. And same, you know, with people's email addresses, plain old, you know, lists of words and things like that, were better with vivid mental imagery, which is why one of the other topics they get into, it's sort of every chapter is on something a little different with memory in the brain, is memorization in the education system, and why, you know, are we really teaching kids to learn knowledge, or are we teaching them rote memorization because we're drilling it into these kids' heads, write things down over and over and over again. And doing that so much, yes, it's going to help. But, you know, I don't remember much of anything from grade 10 history because we're not so good with just constant writing words, trying to memorize that way.
Bill's really good. If Bill needs to remember a series of letters and type them into a particular game, rather than just remember them in his head, he writes them down on a piece of paper. And then types them in.
I cheated while we were playing a video game. That's
said piece of paper.
I think I read about that earlier.
Yeah, that's the end game here. You know, that's what you're saying about like rote memorization versus actual like knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That's a major complaint of my wife's. She teaches grade 2, and she'd probably be thrilled to hear that her little hypothesis is substantiated in like actual text, because she sees it all the time, right? You ask a kid, especially for standardized testing.
Mm-hmm.
Standardized testing comes about, they have to know X, Y, Z. So they just like beat that into their skulls, but ask them 2 weeks later.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, and it's already flitted away because there's so much other junk that they got to keep in there.
Yeah.
That, and math is like that for me. It's like, can I do math or do I just remember a lot of answers?
Yeah.
You know, like if someone shouted out multiply two numbers together, I instantly can do that in my head, but am I figuring it out or am I just remembering what the answer to 9 times 8 is?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because something kind of just popped into my head. You know, we're talking about your wife as a teacher. And so I took math all throughout high school and I got into, you know, advanced functions, calculus, that kind of thing. And I honestly never use it, so I don't remember any of it. But what I do remember is from elementary school, grade, you know, 3 or whatever, when they're teaching you the multiplication tables, they had these tapes of songs for every, so there'd be one for like when you're multiplying things by 3 and by 4 and by 5, And each one had a different tune that went with it of, you know, what 3 times 4 is, all the way up to, I think it went up to times 12. And I remember every fucking tune of that song.
Really?
And how it goes for each of the, you know, the different numbers, because it was like this music that was going on in your head. It's not just, I have to write out what, you know, 3 times 5 is 85 times to remember what the answer is.
Right.
So it's adding that mental vivid imagery to implant it more into your brain.
And it, there's something about combining the knowledge with another sense. So visually, or in your case, the musical aspect of it. But don't they say that scent is the strongest sense tied to memory?
I've heard that.
So wouldn't it be weird, like, if you were studying to somehow factor in scent into what you were studying? Because if it's effective to sing the, well, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you know, like everybody knows that tune, right? Or, you know, doing the memory palace, because adding a second sense into just the exercise of remembering helps make it more effective. I wonder if there's something to that. It's probably already been done, but I wonder if there's something to that. If,
yeah.
Unless that's just like, you know, what the cologne commercials told me, that sense is the strongest sense tied to memory, and it's total bullshit, and they got me.
Well, I think in a sense it can be, because for me, I do find that true as far as experiences or moments in your life, whereas I don't know what the application would be to go along with, you know, facts,
right,
learning specific right knowledge, rather than, you know, oh, I smelled, you know, apple pie the other day and it took me back to that one Christmas and, you know, my grandpa was like, you know, taught me how to, I don't know, build something or whatever.
I can still remember what my buddy's house, when he lived back at home, his house smelled weird, like almost like dill pickle chips. But I can remember, I can't smell the smell right now, but I can instantly remember what that smell smells like.
Yeah.
And the second I walked into his door, I can remember that. I can remember what that smell is. And now that I'm picturing that smell in my head, I can completely remember the layout of his house. Because when you're standing outside his door, it's just whatever's going on. Someone's barbecuing or having a bonfire or something like that. But the second you walk into his door, oh man, your house smells like dill pickles. And I can remember walking in through the entryway and into the kitchen and everything like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe there's something to that, man. That's weird.
Yeah.
God, the brain is weird, man.
Yeah. They do touch on a lot of really cool instances like that in here that we get. You know, there's a chapter on this guy who's a total savant, I guess, autistic savant that they, you know, they're referred to, and he is supposedly, you know, debunking it a little bit because Joshua Ford, the author, kind of ended up doing was having multiple interviews with this guy over, you know, the course of a couple years, and finding that, you know, his whole thing, I think, was dates and calendar dates and, you know, being able to tell you what day of the week, you know, March 5th, 1924 was, but was able to, you know, not necessarily give the right answer certain times, and but also getting into interviewing people with synesthesia, the whole...
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah, which is something that I've always been really interested in, the idea of the way your brain is wired, sometimes getting crossed and thinking, you know, using that as a memory technique, like, okay, being able to, say, multiply crazy huge numbers together because of the mental image it gives you, or, you know, seeing certain colors associating with certain numbers and or certain smells with certain words and that kind of thing. Chapters on Alzheimer's, you know, this this man with extreme short-term memory loss to the point where you could ask him a question and he would, you know, has a solidified memory up until I think about like around 1980s, which is when he had some kind of accident or was like a stroke or something to cause him to, you know, affect his short-term memory. And so he could tell you, you know, thinking the current president of the United States is in 1980. He's never heard, you know, he doesn't know who Bill Clinton is. He doesn't know who George W. Bush is. He's like, oh, okay, you know, and then, you know, 2 minutes later, he'd absolutely forget again because, you know,
Whoa.
And
wow.
Walking around the neighborhood, you know, still happily married. He finds out every day that who his wife is.
Nice.
And and he can go for a walk around town and meet all of these people who he's met every single day and are his next door neighbors and have been
for
20
years. It's like he's living Groundhog Day.
Yeah, and has never met and thinks he's never met them before, and they just, you know, they know, and he's the sweet old man who just, you know, walks around the neighborhood.
If
and
his wife was
is
getting
forgetful.
Sick of him, she could just sub in one of her friends and take a break for a day.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah.
It's like, I guess, yeah, maybe not Groundhog Day. It's more like 50 First Dates.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what that is.
That's right.
It's wild, you know, and I think maybe it's just because where I come from, like, I work in IT, right? So I hear you talking about, like, this guy's palace method or whatever is to compartmentalize memories in specific rooms of your house. That's just files and folders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's like,
good point.
At some point, we're going to figure out a way to like get at that data that's up there, you know, like.
Yeah. And along with the Alzheimer's chapter, one of the topics that came up that I ended up doing a little bit of research into later was something called Ribot's Law of retrograde amnesia, which is the idea that when something happens, like it's very common in Alzheimer's patients, people with dementia, the more recent memories are what goes first because they haven't had as much time to be ingrained in your memory as everything, you know, you can remember what, you know, things way further back in your life because you've had more time to reflect on them and spend remembering them than you have current memories, despite the fact that they happened more recently to you. So, you know, like you said, digging back into those file folders, maybe using these memory tricks to solidify your more recent folders because they're what's more likely to go first. That's just with the way that the brain works.
That's phone numbers for me. I can remember the phone numbers of all my kids. I was all my friends that I had when I was a kid. You know, when I grew up and I was in public school from, you know, kindergarten to grade 8, we were the same class going through the whole way.
Yeah.
Those guys probably moved out of those houses 15 years ago, but I remember all their childhood phone numbers. I don't know what your phone number is.
Yeah. Because you had to memorize them because that was the only way you were ever going to know what they were.
Absolutely.
And now we're relying so much on external memory devices, GPSs, you know, cell phone contact lists, that we've stopped training our memories like this. You know, they talk about how all of these scholars before, you know, books became widely published, before the invention of printing presses, could memorize entire huge, like, medieval tomes.
That's crazy.
Or poems, epic poems, because they had to. Not everyone could get a book, you know, $20 at, you know, Chapters.
You just had to hire a guy to recant it to you.
Because they had to. Like, that's the kicker, because they had to.
Because there was one copy, and it was chained up in a church somewhere, and they had to spend months going through it, learning it word by word so that they could use it later, scholars and...
Do you guys think those, when it comes to like, okay, so when it comes to training your memory, do you think those like Lumosity brain games or anything like that actually work? You know?
Well, they all...
I mean, they claim to.
Of course. They all use that term neuroplasticity, which is supposed to be like the, you know...
The ability of your brain
flexibility of your brain to, you know... They're like, your brain is a muscle. You have to exercise your brain, which I think there is something to it, but...
Yeah, I guess that an example of that would be studying, right? Or that that rote memory thing where you're flexing your brain muscle by reading that chapter again, or by sitting down and trying to remember what you know, the capital of Sweden is, or something like that.
Mm. Yeah,
yeah. I don't know. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and so there's one wow fact that I bookmark that I want to leave you guys with because I think it's going to blow your minds a little bit.
Okay.
So
I'm ready.
One of the these memory champions that he encountered along the way, his name is Ben Pridmore, and Ben Pridmore developed one of his mental techniques because there's different challenges that you face during the memory championships. There's like they'll give you picture or like all these pictures of random people and tell you their names, and then you have to match them up later. You have to memorize shuffled decks of cards, unpublished random poems, word by word, you know, completely grammar to the point, everything. So this Ben Pridmore guy has developed a system in his brain for memorizing shuffled decks of cards and placing like specific mental images with each face, number, suit. And his record is that he can memorize 27 decks of shuffled cards in an hour.
Shut up.
Yeah.
I mean, the trouble is it's so far removed from my experience.
Yeah, like that doesn't even... That's like when if you were to say like there's $1 trillion in debt or something like that. Like that's just...
The guys in those flying squirrel suits floating through the mountains and stuff like that. I'm like, that is so far away. Wow.
Yeah.
From what I can't even fathom what that feels like.
Yeah.
27 decks of cards.
You could
52
never,
cards in a deck.
Ever lie to that guy.
Yeah.
Ever. Like you couldn't even tell stupid little lies.
Oh, hey, Bill Dungy, how are you? Yeah, you remember that $17 that I lent you on February 17th of 1997?
Yeah.
With interest, that would be.
Yeah. They get into how he does it, and there's, you know, each card gets associated with it. It's like a person, a thing, and an action. So, which is where the title of the book comes from, Moonwalking with Einstein, is like one of their mental images of a card that they had to memorize. It was like something moonwalking with Einstein.
But then you'd have to remember the image that you associated with it.
And that's why they spend years and years getting ready to expand their memory. That's what, you know, the prep time for memory championships is, you know, collecting places you can use as memory palaces and developing these mental systems to put in place with all these cards.
Because even with that memory palace thing, I still had to remember that it was the eggs dancing in front at my front door. And I had to remember what my mom was saying. And I had to remember what item was on my bed. Yeah. I remember it was eggs, call me, and shoes. But, I mean, it could come a point where... not that I didn't remember it, but maybe I used that same technique again with grapefruits, call your grandmother, and a hat.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I flip the eggs and the grapefruit together in one of those chains. You know what I mean? That's fascinating.
Well, and that's all just within, you know, a couple of minutes. I mean,
he can do that in an hour.
Yeah, this is, pre-memorizing things, all this time that they take prepping. It says that he has 2,704 possible two-card combinations pre-memorized in his head that he can then pull out over the course of an hour to memorize 27 shuffled decks of cards.
That would be a fascinating documentary, following this guy getting ready for the memory championships. You know, screw putting the spelling bee on ESPN. I want the memory championships.
Yeah.
If they can have steeplechase televised during the Olympics, they can put the American Memory Championships on TV.
Well,
my God.
And apparently the Americans are nothing compared to the Europeans in this. Like the European...
Oh, it's because they don't have good Netflix there.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, hey, do you want to watch Netflix? They're like, no, it's the same stuff all the time. I'm just going to go memorize these 14 decks of cards.
Yeah.
Before we give the ninja time to talk about the thing he wants to talk about, what was that book called?
Moonwalking with Einstein. And it's got a 3.8 on Goodreads. So, although a lot of the comments and reviews left were, this taught me nothing about Einstein. I was looking for a biography about Albert Einstein.
The follow-up book.
Didn't teach me anything.
Mom. Reading the freaking
reading the blurb
jacket
on the back of it.
God.
Yeah.
So what do you got for us, homeboy?
Okay, so I got a book. It was called The Hidden Life of Trees, and the way that I decide to get into things, it followed the same path. So Joe Rogan mentioned it in passing on his podcast, and then I happened to catch a tweet just randomly floated through my timeline from Michael Pollan, the guy who wrote Cooked and did the documentary for that. And then I'm like, that's two people that are distant enough from each other that this might be worth me reading. So I decided to read a little blurb about it off Amazon, and then I'm like, okay, I'm picking it up. So I started reading it just one night. I wasn't feeling good, and I really this is so lame, but when I'm sick and not feeling good, the only thing that works for me, not NyQuil, not pills or nothing, I read a book in a super hot tub, I'm good the next day. I can cure diseases with that. And I'm reading this book, and then I'm like, I got about 17 pages into it in 5 minutes. And I'm like, I can't enjoy this book. I need to study this book.
Yeah.
It blew my mind that quickly. I'm only 90 pages into about 244 pages, and I can go for 7 hours. So get some snacks. Go get a refill on your drink. So... this is the blurb that they'll have on Amazon, and this is when I knew what hooked me. It says, are trees social beings? So, sorry, this is The Hidden Life of Trees. Are Trees Social Beings? In this international bestseller, forester and author Peter Wohlleben convincingly makes the case that, yes, the forest is a social network. He draws on groundbreaking scientific discoveries to describe how trees are like human families. Tree parents live together with their children, communicate with them, support them as they grow, share nutrients with those who are sick or struggling, and even warn each other of impending dangers. Wohlleben also shares his deep love of woods and forests, explaining the amazing processes of life, death, and regeneration he has observed in his woodland. After you have read Wohlleben's book, A Walk in the Woods Will Never Be the Same Again. Now, I was just like, okay, hold on a minute. These trees are like, they raise their kids and everything like that. Because Bill and I mean, if you're listening to the Benchcast Book Club and you haven't listened to the Benchcast, Bill and I like to just spit about philosophy all the time. And one day we were just having a typical Wednesday afternoon existential crisis. And I'm like, we were talking about, it was months ago, about how you drive to work and you just pass fascinating stuff all around you.
Yeah.
You're driving through, you're not even there. You're just driving by memory. You're not paying attention. You're just driving to work. And then meanwhile, half a kilometer off the road in this forest is like little bugs and microbes that are, there's a goddamn like ecosystem in a square foot of forest soil or something like that that's happening whether we're paying attention to it or not. This was exactly that conversation in a book. So there's a couple pieces I found really interesting. He talks about the oldest living tree. He talks about like life in the slow lane. So the way trees grow is a lot different than the way we grow, and we're used to fast-paced lives. And if you live a slow-paced life, you're either lazy or you're wasting your time, right? Like, that's just agreed upon. If you're not zooming around and memorizing 27 decks of cards or things like that, you're just not making use of your time. It's all got to be now, man. Tonight's the night. Got to go. It's the time of our lives. And that's not how trees work. So he talks about this 95-year-old tree in Sweden. Oh, sorry, 9,500-year-old tree.
I was going to say, 95 is not
a
very old tree.
Yeah, it's a 95-year-old tree. It's ancient. No, there's a 9,500-year-old spruce in Sweden. And it's just like, okay, 9,500 years. You look at that and you're like, that on its own is fascinating. But then when you think about that, it's like, what has that tree been witness to? You know, what types of things have happened near or under that tree? Like, what have you ever, it's like one of those like short black and white films or something like that, where they just show like a building or a room and there's all the different things throughout the different decades that occurred in that room. And that room is the constant and people grew up, or a bench at the park. And there's like this two young kids who play together on the park. And then as teenagers, they go and have their first date. And then when they're married, they go get their wedding pictures there. And then they go and their kids are playing. And it's like, but the bench is the constant. But this is a tree that's been the constant for 9,500 friggin' years. And it's like, how lucky is it that that tree didn't get hit by lightning, didn't get cut down by some caveman dude who needed to make a fire, or didn't get pushed over by a mammoth or an elephant or something, or they didn't need to put a highway through it. A 9,500-year-old living creature is just, it's a mind blow. Like, that's just insane, you know? And it's like, how long ago were we able to determine what the age of trees were? Because you look at a tree that's 9,500 years old, and you're like, oh, don't cut that down. No, put a plaque in front of it and let's revere this thing. But when was that first able to happen? Because in the 1700s, it's like, whatever, I need some wood to cook this deer or my family's going to starve to death, right? And, you know, so that was like in the first two pages. And then it started getting into these, you know, it starts getting into more the mechanics of trees. Because, okay, we're starting to think of trees as a living creature and like plants and da-da-da-da and stuff like that. But it's like, okay, so let's think of a tree as a living creature. How is it alive? How do we know that it's alive? Well, if it doesn't get enough nutrients, or if it's damaged enough, or if it doesn't get enough water, it dies. So, I mean, okay, it's a living creature. But can it feel? You know, like, is it possible for trees to feel? Apparently, it is. And it's also possible for trees to communicate. So I just wanted to read you a little piece here that I found pretty interesting. It was talking about giraffes and the way that there's these trees called acacia trees, and when they're being eaten, they send a chemical communication to each other So it says, if a giraffe starts eating an African acacia, the tree releases a chemical into the air that signals a threat is at hand. As the chemical drifts through the air and reaches the other trees, they, in quotes, smell it and are warned of the danger. Even before the giraffe reaches them, the other trees begin producing toxic chemicals. Insect pests are dealt with slightly differently. The saliva of leaf-eating insects can be, in quotations, tasted by the leaf being eaten. In response, the tree sends out a chemical signal that attracts predators that feed on that particular leaf-eating insect. Life in the slow lane is clearly not always dull. So it's like, okay, when I tell you that trees communicate with each other, you're like, that's stupid. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of in my life. And then you can take it back. It's like, okay, so trees can give off smells, right? And you see that every spring when a lilac bush is in bloom. And why do we smell that tree? Well, it's because of its flowers that we smell. Well, within those flowers is pollen. And you need pollen to pollinate other trees. And that's their way of basically having hot tree sex and producing fruit and things like that. That's not a stretch of the imagination. So if pollen from one tree can get into the little pollen catching areas of another tree to bear, and that's what they need to bear fruit, we all get that. That's where pears come from. That's where tomatoes come from. So is it that much of a stretch to think that they can release a scented chemical, but also be able to pick that up from another tree and therefore release a chemical within itself, just like he describes with the giraffe eating the acacia tree? And that's its sort of like, it's not only its own defense mechanism, a net mechanism, but then you can alert the group to a certain level away from it of the impending danger. It's crazy, man. And then it makes me wonder, okay, so specifically the acacia, when a giraffe bites into some sweet, juicy acacia leaves on one tree, it lets all its little acacia homies around it know that, like, okay, make your leaves taste real bad, otherwise this giraffe's just going to strip you dry. What happens when I pick a tomato out of my tomato garden? I'm not picking every tomato. I'm picking 4 or 5 tomatoes and then maybe going back to get 6 or 7 the other day. Do the little tomatoes communicate with each other? Is every consecutive tomato that I pick going to taste more bitter or different in some kind than the first one I picked? Maybe tomatoes don't communicate the same way, but it's possible they could, right? It's just weird to think about, like, does that happen in our own garden? It's stuff you never stop to think about.
Never mind that. When you got to cut the grass.
Oh, can you imagine?
Genocide. It's genocide.
Well, I always, when people are talking about vegans, and they're like, yeah, you know, like when you bite into a carrot and it crunches, that's the carrot screaming because carrots are living beings too and all this stuff. And
oh, there's a good Tool song where they're talking about like how it's like the genocide of the carrots, you know, and they screamed and we heard their carrot cries or something.
Yeah.
Okay, this is fascinating too. So when we talk about just it, basically what this book does for me is it just gets me to think of, I like the way you said life in the slow lane and stuff like that. It's really important. About Ariana Grande's new album's coming out. You got to get hype about that, right? And then Christmas is coming up. So you got to buy presents and you got to buy shit for people. And you know that guy's mortgage is closing next week, so you got to make sure you send the documents to the lawyers. All this stuff's super important, right? And we all know that. And we know the ins and outs of our favorite sports teams. And we know all the processes to just get signed on to the computer at work. And I found this really fascinating, too. So he says, before you plunge into this book to find out what I have discovered just by stepping outside my back door, I want to tell you a story about Yellowstone National Park in the United States to show you just how vital undisturbed forests and woodlands are to the future of our planet and how our appreciation for trees affects the way we interact with the world around us. It all starts with the wolves. Wolves disappeared from Yellowstone, the world's first national park, in the 1920s. When they left, the entire ecosystem changed. Elk herds in the park increased their numbers and began to make quite a meal of the aspens, willows, and cottonwoods that line the streams. Vegetation therefore declined, and animals that depended on the trees left. The wolves were absent for 70 years. When they returned, the elk's languorous browsing days were over. As the wolf packs kept the herds on the move, browsing diminished, and the trees sprang back. The roots of the cottonwoods and willows once again stabilized stream banks and slowed the flow of water. This, in turn, created space for animals such as the beavers to return. These industrious builders could now find the materials they needed to construct their lodges and raise their families. The animals that depended on the riparian meadows came back as well. the wolves turned out to be better stewards of the land than people, creating conditions that allowed the trees to grow and exert their influence on the landscape. And it's just fascinating to think that, you know, the Yellowstone National Park, it's being managed by people who know how to manage the land. They got land management degrees and everything like that. And a bunch of dumb wolves who can't parallel park were the things that they're like, no, I'll show you how to make everything better. Because if all of a sudden X animal left those meadows where they're flooded, you know, they're going extinct or they're just leaving and people are like, why? Like, why is this happening? How long would it have taken them to draw those parallels back to be like, oh, we need the wolves? Because if the elk can just set up shop and strip all the leaves off the tree in one area, that's bad for the whole ecosystem. The wolves keep them on the run. They keep them scared so they can't eat as much. It's just crazy that connection everything has. I'll skip a bunch because, I could go on forever. It's crazy. The one thing that you might find fascinating, because I know that you're an IT guy and you probably understand the examples that he's drawing, but he's talking about how fungi in the mycelium of fungi, which is basically like mushrooms' roots, for lack of a better term, act as a fiber optic network for trees to communicate. So they said that trees, they send electric signals, much like our brain does to our body, but we do it much quicker, and they do it at about an inch per second or 3 inches per second. So messages move a lot slower than it does within our own body. However, within the fungi, within their mycelium, information travels a lot quicker. So that's why if you've ever gone to the garden center and you go to get a tree, they recommend you use a product called Mike, which is mycorrhizal bacteria, which is basically a fungi that helps. It grows within the root system and it allows the roots to flourish. Hmm. So there's communication between the trees and the forest. And it's just insane that, you know, it's like the symbiotic relationship. But it's, he uses like the term, it's basically like the internet for trees. And it's just like, it's insane to think about how we have fiber optic cables and our whole world runs on the internet. But trees and mushrooms have been essentially doing that. We didn't discover the internet by looking at these trees and mushrooms. But now that we have the ability to look at those things, there's an interesting parallel between that and the way that we communicate with each other. It's crazy, man.
I am completely willing to accept that as truth. Because
I mean, none of us would be able to say, no, that's wrong and this is why. Because, I mean, what do we know? But the things he says in here, it's just like, okay, he'll make a claim that trees, I told you, so if you follow our podcast on Facebook, I wrote trees scream when they're thirsty. That sounds ridiculous. Trees do not scream when they're thirsty. Trees emit a low frequency vibration when they are lacking in water. And the other trees nearby can pick up on that low frequency vibration. And therefore, what they'll do when they receive that signal is kind of hold back on taking water out of the ground. Like they'll kind of pass off the resources to the other trees that need it, because a tree on its own is nowhere near as likely to survive as a tree in a forest, because a tree would be getting wind on all sides, and wind dries out the soil. It pushes on the tree. It can cause branches to snap. It can cause the trunk to sway. But in a forest, the outside trees are kind of playing defense, but that's why there's no, you know, there's no wind whipping through a forest. It's all dispersed by the leaves. That's why in the summertime when it's really windy, you don't really notice it. But in the wintertime when there's no leaves on the trees and you're driving across the street, the wind's just whipping across because there's no leaves to kind of diffuse that wind at all. So as a forest, everyone stands a better chance of surviving. The leaves that they drop, a single tree that drops his leaves, it can disperse all over. But in a forest, everyone drops their leaves and it decomposes and it helps the soil out. It keeps the soil together so the soil doesn't erode, and then the roots are exposed and it can topple over. So the trees share their resources because they're, I know it sounds really hippie, but they're stronger as a team than they are on their own, you know?
Again, I'm not surprised, right? Yeah. I mean, and take a look at everything in nature, right?
It's crazy, man.
How far in are you to that book?
I'm about 100, based on this, I'm about 100 pages in.
So next time we get together, you should be still pretty much making your way through that.
I'm starting to go a little bit more because I knew that I have about 17 notes here and I'm not going to read them all. But I mean, I was like, okay, I've got more than enough for this episode of the book. But honestly, like, that's just a couple things that were fascinating. Like, they were talking about, can we accept that fungi, if plants are living creatures and fungi are more advanced than trees are in a way, are they more animal than plant? Is a fungi more animal than plant? It talked about how trees are able to have, or moss is able to grow in the cracks of trees, older trees' bark. And then when it rains, it washes the nutrients that are produced by the moss down to the ground and fertilizes the tree. Hmm. So it's to the benefit of the tree to allow or to be able to have moss to, in a sense, impregnate its bark. Or even spruce trees. So it was mentioning the way that spruce trees are shaped, the way their needles and everything work helps to protect the tree. Like, just, it's one of those things where it's like, is the tree shaped that way because of this, or did the tree survive because it happened to be shaped this way? But it's just, when you look at a tree, it's like, oh, that's just a dumb tree. And then it's like, okay, so now I'm looking at trees and I'm like, oh my God, I can see the shape of the tree and the way that all the branches, and it perfectly supports its weight. And it's just, or then I'm driving to work and I see a forest. I'm like, oh, look at all those Bob Ross style happy little trees. And then you just see that one tree and it's like, oh, that poor tree's not having a good day. You know, it's such a fascinating book. I really, you know, reading this book has done just something to my brain. Trees and plants are fascinating on the way, but I'm just really fascinated about being fascinated, you know, and it's made me want to read a whole bunch of more really fascinating things, because a lot of the stuff we do is fascinating. I mean, you're hearing my voice potentially through your car. You're driving through this steel and plastic and rubber machine that runs on gas that was made out of oil, which is made out of dead dinosaur bodies that sat there for thousands. That on its own is fascinating. But at the same time, we're used to it as really boring. Mm-hmm. And things that seem really boring, like, oh, moss grows on a tree. Yeah, that shit happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but the mechanics behind it, because they're so matter-of-fact and it's just the way it is, that is fascinating to me. It's just such a cool book. And like, I'm only a third of the way into it. I expect to have my mind blown about 1,745 more times by the time I'm done it.
Well, and it's answered an age-old question for us, too. Because if trees scream, then if a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, it does make a sound.
And other trees hear it. Only if it's thirsty. If trees falls in the forest and it's perfectly good on water, maybe it's quiet.
But if it's dehydrated,
no, because everybody
falls,
be like, bro, are you okay? Be like, yeah, no, I'm good.
I'm just going to do this from memory. But the one piece about how the blurb said about parenting. So I'm like, okay. Explain to me how trees parent their little baby trees. And what they do is they steal resources. Older trees will steal resources from their younger offspring. And it's like, the reason for it is if you remember in biology, like grade 10 biology, and they do like they talk about the cells and the cell membranes and the whole this, that, and the other thing. Every year when the trees grow, if they're starved for nutrients, they grow very small and they're stunted. And their cell growth is very small and therefore very compact. So over 60, 70, 80 years that these trees grow, they may only get 10, 12 feet tall. So they're real dense little brick shit houses. And then when its parent tree, which doesn't necessarily reach the ability to have offspring till it's 200 years old, eventually senses or notices that these offspring trees are large enough and they're ready, the tree will stop stealing resources from it and therefore start to eventually die, and it'll topple and fall over and therefore leaves a hole in the canopy. And now those young trees that have a good, strong, sturdy base will get the sunlight and then they can grow. Because if they grow too quickly, their cells will be too large. They won't be dense enough. There'll be too much air in their cells, and a good, strong windstorm could snap them in half. And it's just like,
wow, that's crazy.
Does that happen on, okay, now that's the thing. Does that happen on purpose or does that happen on accident? Because you can easily see, once you start putting all these little huhs together, how that could be an intentional act.
Well,
It's just wild.
To bring it all back, that's the Tao. It just happens because it's the way of things.
Yeah.
That's just how it is. It doesn't matter. That's just how it is.
It's unreal, man. I really, really recommend picking up that book. The Hidden Life of Trees. I'm probably butchering the poor guy's name, but Peter Wallabin.
We have The Hidden Life of Trees. We have
Moonwalking with Einstein.
It's not an Einstein autobiography.
No,
no. And we have Tao, The Watercourse Way from Alan Watts. My name is Bill. You are?
I'm Mr. Wyatt today.
Okay, Mr. Wyatt.
And I'm Marissa.
And finally, Marissa. We three are the core components, only components, of the Benchcast Book Club. Going forward, I don't know that we have a specific outline for what we're doing here. It's just kind of fun, and that's what we're going to do. Next time, we'll probably talk about some of the same, a little bit different, maybe a lot different. Don't really know until we get there. In any case, go find yourself a good book and read it, because you don't have enough time not to. Am I right?
That's right. Unless you're a tree. Then you could have up to 9,500 years.
Would that be cannibalism? Trees read books?
I did find it very interesting that I'm reading a book that extols the virtue of trees that's, like, printed on paper. That'd be like reading, like, a medical textbook that's just, like, carved into a hunk of flesh.
Maybe it's printed on hemp.
It's possible. I would hope so.
There you go. It is Canada. We're allowed to do that up here. All right, Internet. That is going to wrap up episode 1. It has been an absolute slice. Go find something to read.